Hello there, and welcome back to our latest episode of A to Easy. I've got Yvonne here with me.
Hello, everyone.
And today we will be revisiting heart failure in our second instalment, in which we'll focus on the acute presentations of heart failure and how we manage these.
Okay, so to recap from last time, we talked about chronic heart failure as a constellation of symptoms that can be categorized into left, right, and congestive heart failure based on the symptoms experienced. We also talked about the investigations and management, which varies based on whether the ejection fraction is preserved or reduced. So how does this stuff differ from what we consider heart failure in an acute context?
Yeah, so whilst chronic heart failure is an entity that will develop gradually over weeks and months, acute heart failure is when a more severe form of the same types of symptoms develop, but very rapidly over hours or days. But otherwise, the symptoms are very much the same as in chronic heart failure. Do you remember those from last time?
So, for left-sided heart failure, you would see breathlessness, orthopnea, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, reduced exercise tolerance, perhaps a new onset cough productive of white sputum, and then symptoms of end-organ hypoperfusions, and ischemia, including cool peripheries, cyanosis, and I guess if severe, pain. And then for right heart failure, you would see peripheral edema, hepatosplenomegaly, erased JVP, ascites, and significant weight gain.
I'd say that's a fairly comprehensive list. I guess I'd also add that particularly in acute presentations with pulmonary edema, if severe, the sputum produced may be pink, frothy, and even bloodstained, and that any respiratory symptoms may be much more severe in an acute setting, such that a patient may well be in respiratory distress. So I guess we should just keep those things in mind as well.
So does an acute exacerbation of heart failure present with all of those things, or is there one presentation that you would say is most common?
I mean, ultimately, I think it depends on the acute cause of the heart failure. And again, the causes of chronic heart failure broadly apply to acute exacerbations. You know, these include myocardial damage, like in acute coronary syndrome, abnormal loading, such as an acute kidney injury or constricted pericarditis, or even high output syndromes like sepsis. And then arrhythmogenic causes, such as a sudden onset atrial fibrillation or heart block that you might get post-MI. I guess we should also remember that if a patient has existing heart failure, any number of factors could destabilise their carefully balanced medical optimization and send them into an acute exacerbation of their pre-existing heart failure.
I see what you mean. So essentially, the etiology and pathophysiology are all broadly the same. It just depends on the time scale. So say we get this acute presentation, how do we manage this?
So as with any acute presentation, we'll always start with an A to E assessment of the patient. And for those who haven't heard of the A to E assessment before, this is a stepwise process that comprises simultaneous examination, investigation, and initial management of your patient to stabilise the different aspects of their life support and focuses on the most critical systems first.
Yes, okay, so A, B, C, D, and E all stand for airway, breathing, circulation, disability, and exposure. I guess checking for a patient's airway is always a good place to start. Although based on what we discussed, I wouldn't have thought this is classically a problem in acute heart failure.
Yeah, I think that would be a fair assessment. But as you say, still important to check anyway. Assuming there's a patent airway, we should then move on to assess their breathing. As pulmonary edema is one of the most common presentations of acute heart failure, I think it's extremely important that we take note of their work of breathing and auscultate the chest to try and pick up signs of pulmonary edema. Do you know what any of those might be?
Well, in pulmonary edema, there's an increase in pulmonary vessel pressure, which forces fluid into the interstitial tissues and air spaces in the lungs. So I would imagine on auscultation, you would hear crepitations with breathing because of the fluid that's present. Although, to be honest, I'm not sure. I can't recall whether that would be fine or cause crepitations.
Yeah, you're absolutely quite right there. Fine end inspiratory crepitations are the key sign of pulmonary edema. The crackling noise is caused by the popping open of alveoli and small airways that have previously been collapsed by the fluid congestion. Coarse crepitations, on the other hand, tend to be associated with bronchiectasis. One of the things I always had difficulty with at medical school was differentiating fine and coarse crepitations. And to be honest, I still find it tricky today. The best way to learn, I think, is just to listen to lots of lungs. However, broadly, fine crepitations sound like tearing apart Velcro, whilst coarse crepitations sound like a car driving across gravel. Aside from this, other signs of congestion can include wheezing. You might also find reduced air entry in the bases of the lungs, with a stony, dull tone on percussion if the patient's congestion is so severe that actually it's causing an effusion. So carrying on with our breathing assessment, what else would you assess?
Well, we'll want to take a respiratory rate and oxygen saturations, which could be high and low respectively if they have pulmonary edema. If their oxygen saturation are low at this point, then I guess the best thing would be to give them some oxygen. So we'll go for 15 liters through a non-rebreather mask initially.
Yeah, I think high flow oxygen and a non-rebreather are very reasonable whilst you're stabilising the patient. And then you can titrate it down as appropriate once the patient is stable. Typically, we aim for saturations of 94 to 98% in most acutely unwell patients, but we can lower this target to 88 to 92% in patients who are at risk of CO2 retention, such as in chronic COPD sufferers. Now, if our patient has an oxygen requirement, what investigation is usually necessary to accompany this?
Well, whenever you're giving oxygen, I would have thought that you always need to take an arterial black gas to ascertain whether they are the type 1 or type 2 respiratory failure.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, technically, you should take an ABG both before and after giving oxygen so that you can track their changing oxygenation and, as you say, characterise any respiratory failure. Practically, if a patient is acutely hypoxic, you should never delay giving oxygen just to get an ABG. In acute heart failure, it can be helpful to look for a metabolic acidosis with a raised lactate if their heart failure is potentially causing hypoperfusion and ischemia. And then there's just one more investigation that needs to happen at this stage of assessment. We mentioned it in passing in our last episode, and that is a chest x-ray. A chest x-ray is really simple, but also super informative test. Classically, there are 5 major signs of heart failure to look for on chest x-ray, and they are also remembered through the first 5 letters of the alphabet. So we have a theme here. Yvonne, do you think you can name the 5 signs of heart failure on chest x-ray?
Oh, now you're challenging me, but let's give it a go. So A is for alveolar shadowing. B is for the curly B lines. C stands for cardiomegaly. D is for upper lobe diversion. And E is for effusion.
Yeah, top marks. Now, let's just briefly revisit each of those so we understand what they actually mean. So alveolar shadowing, also known as airspace opacification, occurs when fluid leaks out of the pulmonary vasculature when the pulmonary pressure gets too high, and the fluid goes into the airspaces, that's the alveoli primarily.
So in this case, would I be right in saying that the left ventricular failure results in a backup of fluid to the lungs, subsequently increased pulmonary vessel pressure, and then fluid leakage out of the vasculature?
Yeah, that would be the right mechanism.
Okay, got that, but where does the fluid go?
Typically, the fluid leaks first into the interstitial spaces and then into the alveolar spaces later on. Leakage into the interstitium will cause interstitial pulmonary edema, which will appear on a chest x-ray as a bilateral lung field opacities, aka whiteness, that extend from the hyla outwards in a fan shape. And this is often referred to as a bat wing pattern of opacification. Once this interstitial bat wing edema has manifested, the fluid then fills up the alveoli and the alveolar edema and shadowing can manifest. And practically, this just means increased opacification across the lung fields. Ultimately, any opacification occurs because fluid attenuates, or that is to say, blocks the passage of x-rays more effectively than gas. And as this opacification worsens, the whiteness that you see on the chest x-ray will just become more homogeneous, i.e. the fluid just looks more and more like a block of white. I definitely recommend looking all of this up on a good online repository, by the way. Seeing the signs in practice x-rays is the best way to understand what they mean and then remember them. So moving on, Yvonne, what are curly B lines?
Okay, I'll be honest. So every time I learn about heart failure, everyone talks about them. But I never really know what they are or really what they look like.
So curly B lines are thin lines, usually only a couple of centimetres in length, in the lung peripheries that represent the septa between lung lobules. They're perpendicular to the pleura surrounding the lungs, and they only become visible when the fluid congestion causes edema of those intralobular septal tissues. So essentially, you can see a pattern of all this fluid filling up the tissues of the lung to make structures visible that normally aren't visible. We then have cardiomegaly, which quite literally translates as big heart, and typically develops in response to chronically increased heart strain. So whilst you might expect to see cardiomegaly in a patient with chronic heart failure who suddenly deteriorates, it may be less common in patients who have a sudden new onset heart failure. We quantify cardiomegaly by measuring the cardiothoracic ratio, and that is to say the ratio of the diameter of the heart on the x-ray to the total chest diameter. And a ratio greater than 0.5 would be considered to show cardiomegaly, i.e. the heart takes up more than half the diameter of the chest. But can we just assess cardiothoracic ratio on any x-ray?
No. This is quite important to say that it's cardiac size is only reliable on a PA film. So whenever you're looking at the film, you should always like check whether it's a PA or an AP, because in an AP x-ray, you can't really reliably measure the cardiothoracic ratio.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the heart is closer to the anterior surface of the chest wall in an AP x-ray, so there's a greater distance for the attenuated x-rays to then spread out before they hit the film. That means there's a risk of over-exaggeration of the actual heart size on the final film. So yeah, you're right. An AP film is less reliable. I always remember that AP is crap, because crap has the letters AP at the end. In an exam situation, when you're given an AP film, I think you could just say, look, whilst this AP film may or may not suggest cardiomegaly, I would want to get a PA film so as to get a more reliable estimate of the cardiothoracic ratio. Moving on from then, so D is for upper lobe diversion. Upper lobe venous diversion results again from increased left heart pressures associated with heart failure. The heart can't pump blood effectively, so the fluid backs up into the pulmonary veins, and once it's filled up the lower pulmonary veins, as per the laws of gravity, the fluid just starts to back up into the upper pulmonary veins.
Okay, so on an x-ray, this literally appears as dilation of the upper lobe pulmonary vessels then?
Yeah, simple as, and you can just look for them branching off from the hilar regions. And then finally, we have effusions. An effusion, for anyone who doesn't know, is a collection of fluid in the pleural cavity. That's the space between the parietal and visceral pleura of the lungs. And this tends to develop in more severe cases. In terms of what we're looking for on x-ray, I just imagine each lung field as like a mug of fluid, and the effusion appears as fluid would in the bottom of a mug. Firstly, you get blunting of the costophrenic angles. As the fluid builds up, you may see fluid in the oblique or horizontal fissures. And then eventually, once it's accumulated to a certain degree, a meniscus will form. That is the little curvy lines at the top of a fluid level. So those are the five signs on x-ray. Sorry we spent so long on those. I think it's probably just important that we get a handle on what we're looking for on a heart failure chest x-ray.
You know what I've always remembered? The acronym of five things to look on a chest x-ray, and never really thought about what they mean or what they look like. So they're actually really, really useful. And now that we've talked about our breathing assessment, what happens when we get to the circulation assessment?
Yes, so here I feel both radial and carotid pulses, check the blood pressure, measure central and peripheral capillary refill times, just to get an idea of fluid status. I think you definitely need a 12-lead ECG to look for any arrhythmogenic causes. And then I'd auscultate the heart. And Yvonne, can you think of any important signs that I might hear on auscultation?
I can think of a couple. So obviously, if there's a valvular cause of the heart failure, then you might hear a corresponding murmur. For example, a pansystolic murmur, loudest at the apex, and on health expiration would suggest mitral regurgitation. Whereas an ejection systolic murmur, loudest in the aortic region, on health expiration and radiating to the carotids, would suggest aortic stenosis. But in addition to this, I believe in heart failure, you can sometimes have a third heart sound.
Yeah, so some heart failure patients will present with this third heart sound making what we call a gallop rhythm. A good way of conceptualizing what the meter sounds like is just to say the word Kentucky. So the third heart sound comes just after the second heart sound, and at this point the aortic and pulmonary valves have closed and the atrioventricular valves have opened, allowing passive filling of the ventricles. An S3 is created when a large volume of left atrial blood hits the wall of a compliant left ventricle. And ventricular compliance is, as it sounds like from the word, and is a product of heart failure, and usually is present in ventricles that have dilated in response to that heart failure. So again, this is possibly a feature you'd expect to see in patients with an acute exacerbation of a chronic heart failure.
That's very helpful to actually visualize. So, going back to our assessment, you mentioned measuring their fluid balance. Surely then we would need to measure the patient's urine output?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This might mean catheterizing the patient, for example, in order to be able to keep strict fluid balance charts, which will really be an essential part of their management. And whilst you're catheterizing, that would probably be a good opportunity to take a small sample for a urine dip. In particular, we're keen to see if there's any protein or hematuria suggestive of a concurrent or even causative renal pathology. Quantifying any edema on examination will also help in identifying your fluid status. And once we've assessed that fluid status, what management would you like to initiate?
I mean, I think it's probably a good idea to put this patient on continuous cardiac monitoring. If their blood pressure is low, one might be tempted to give fluids, as we do for most of our other patients. But in this case, I feel that would be a very, very bad decision, considering the patient is already on fluid overloaded.
Probably not going to help them out with no. their fluids. If they have a low blood pressure, they could be in cardiogenic shock. So you might want to consider talking to critical care outreach and maybe starting some inotropes. But I don't think we'll go into that too much detail today. That can be quite complex. For today, let's assume that the patient has a normal or high blood pressure. What they do need really is IV access. And then at this point, we can take some pertinent blood tests to help us. So what bloods would you get?
So based on the last episode, I think we said FVCs, user knees, and renal function, blood glucose, HbA1c, and then a BNP.
Well remembered. Yeah, all of those are absolutely fine. BNP may be less reliable in an acute setting for the reasons that we discussed in part one, but it's still a very useful piece of information to have either way. In an acute setting, I'd probably suggest a few other tests as well. A troponin will be really helpful if acute coronary syndrome is one of your differentials for the cause of the heart failure. A CRP may also be handy. Whilst typically unremarkable in chronic heart failure, CRP can be raised in acute heart failure, and so may be helpful in adding to the overall diagnostic picture if you're unsure. Thyroid function will be important, as both hypo and hyperthyroidism can cause acute heart failure. And then finally, you could consider a D-dimer if a PE is a suspected cause of acute right heart failure, although I would really like to stress that it's important to remember how non-specific D-dimer tests can be. So be careful with your D-dimers.
Okay, so to recap, we have FVC, user knees, glucose, HbA1c, BNP, although less useful than a chronic, troponin, CRP, TFTs, standing for thyroid function test, and possibly a D-dimer. That seems reasonable. So is that all for RC circulation?
In a way, yes. At this point, I think we just await the results of our investigations and begin to treat accordingly, really. I'll just briefly outline disability and exposure, as we don't really have an awful lot of time to go into those in depth today. Disability looks at the alert status and Glasgow Coma Scale, GCS, and that's where you check pupillary reflexes and gross neurological function. Exposure, on the other hand, is where you'd perform a head-to-toe examination to look for any other concerning features, and exposure is a really good opportunity to look for some of the more obscure symptoms and signs that you outlined at the beginning of this episode.
So having done our A to E assessment, we've gotten a lot of information, but equally have already started treating a lot of things. What would be our next steps? Is there much to do?
Yeah, well, there's plenty still to do as it happens. before we move on to treatment, as in chronic heart failure, there's one key investigation that we need to get. What do you think that would be?
Bedside echo?
100% correct. As before, in episode one, this really is the gold standard of heart failure diagnosis. And you will need an echo at some point, even if you leave it until after you've stabilised your patient. Furthermore, whilst you're managing this patient in hospital, you're going to be wanting daily weights throughout their stay so that you can track how much fluid they're offloading as you diurese them, i.e. whether or not your treatment is working.
Well, that brings us nicely into the subject of treatment. So based on what we discussed, it sounds like the goal of treatment realistically is to offload all of the fluid that's overloading the body's various systems.
You took the words right out of my mouth. And as with chronic heart failure, we can offer conservative medical and surgical measures to achieve this. For example, sitting the patient up in bed is a great first step to help them with their breathing, as they will likely have some degree of orthopnea. We then move on to medications, which are the mainstay of management here. The medications we give will partially depend on the cause of this acute heart failure. If the heart failure is secondary to a sudden onset arrhythmia, such as atrial fibrillation, then we'll need to treat the arrhythmia, be that with digoxin or bisoprolol in the case of atrial fibrillation, maybe adenosine if it's a supraventricular tachycardia, or DC cardioversion or amiodarone if it's a ventricular tachycardia. If the cause is an acute coronary syndrome, then you'll be giving your standard ACS treatment, sublingual GTN spray, IV morphine, metoclopramide, 300 milligrams of aspirin stat, 180 milligrams of ticagrelor, and plus minus fondaparinux if they've got an NSTEMI. Those variables aside, diuretics still form the absolute core of heart failure management. Yvonne, do you remember what kinds of diuretics we said we preferred to use in heart failure last episode?
So it was loop diuretics such as furosemide and bumetanide, right? The reason being because they are better at preserving kidney function, if I remember correctly.
Absolutely right. Furosemide is the drug of choice here. Now, whereas with chronic heart failure, we try to stick to oral diuretics, in acute heart failure, there's a much greater urgency to stabilise the patient. And so you want a fast-acting route that will give you quick results. Therefore, we tend to use intravenous furosemide, typically 40 to 80 milligrams initially, but with room for further doses if the fluid overload is severe and refractory. Following IV loop diuretics, patients need constant re-evaluation of their clinical fluid status, and that will mean repeat lung auscultation, and eventually, once the patient is stable, they'll need further optimization of their heart failure medications. Now, just a point here that if patients have pleural effusions, that is to say, fluid in the space between the visceral and parietal pleura of the lungs, these can most often be managed through heart failure medication optimization and diuresis. However, there is a case for a small minority of patients where if despite medical optimization the effusions persist or are recurrent, then a more surgical approach may be required, and this would typically involve inserting a chest drain.
Okay, so before you go on, I just want to say that chest drains are very physics-related, let's say, physics-focused, let's say. And it took me ages to get my head around them in medical school. So why don't you start off by giving us some summary of what a chest drain does?
Yeah, I have to say I'm completely in the same boat as you on this one. It took me ages to understand chest drains. Essentially, a chest drain is simply a tube inserted through the chest wall between the ribs and into the pleural cavity to allow air, blood, fluid, or pus to drain from that space. So the chest drain is connected to three bottles in sequence. Okay, the first bottle collects the draining fluid. The second bottle produces a watertight seal to prevent the fluid from returning to the lungs. And then the third bottle allows you to regulate the suction pressure, respectively. When the patient exhales, intrathoracic pressure is increased. This forces fluid out of that pleural cavity and into the chest drain tube. This fluid collects in the first bottle, and that fluid then displaces air from the first bottle and forces it into the second bottle, where the air is bubbled through a watertight seal. This prevents it from travelling back when the patient breathes in again. The second bottle is then also connected to a third bottle, which has openings to the sort of room air and suction, and that allows the suction pressure to be changed and regulated as well. I wouldn't learn chest drains in any more detail than that at this stage. As you say, it can get quite physics-y, But Yvonne, let's say I wanted to insert a chest drain. Can I put it anywhere, or is there a specific part of the chest wall where the chest drain should go in?
I know this one. So there's a region on the lateral aspect of the chest wall called the safe triangle. Ironically, this is a rhomboid-shaped region demarcated by the lateral border of pectoralis major, the fifth intercostal space, the lateral border of latimus dorsi, and the base of the axilla. So this is the optimal region in which it is safest to insert a chest drain.
Excellent. Now, if we're draining a patient's effusion, the process obviously doesn't end once the fluid has been drained. That collected fluid can actually be very helpful diagnostically, even if at this stage we're already reasonably confident that we have a pleural effusion secondary to acute heart failure. Any fluid collection can be classified as transudative or exudative. Do you want to take us through what those words mean?
Okay, so a transudative fluid is fluid with a low protein and lactate dehydrogenase concentration. Transudates are typically caused by processes that either increase the hydrostatic pressure, and that is a pressure that's created by fluid volume, or processes that reduce the oncotic pressures in the pleural space. Oncotic pressure is an osmotic pressure created by proteins in a fluid, such as a plasma, that keep the fluid from spilling out into spaces like the pleura in the body. Causes include the failures. So that's heart failure, liver failure, and nephrotic syndrome, which is basically renal failure, and hypoalbuminemia. Exudates, on the other hand, have a high protein versus a low protein, and also have a high lactose dehydrogenase concentration, as they are often associated with a local cell death, followed by a leakage of the cell contents into the pleural space. The causes can include aggressive inflammatory processes that can lead to cell death, such as pneumonia, TB, pancreatitis, lupus, and malignancy.
Yep, so those are the two classifications. Now, to help us characterize the fluid in the effusion, we can use a tool known as Light's criteria. I always find Light's criteria very scary, but Light's criteria are a collection of three criteria that help us to specifically characterize pleural effusions and identify whether the effusion is a transudate or an exudate. And this will then allow us to really identify the etiology of the effusion.
Okay, so what are these three criteria then?
Yes, so if any one of the following three criteria are met, then the effusion can be considered as an exudate. Firstly, pleural protein to serum protein ratio greater than 0.5, i.e. the level of protein in the effusion is high enough to abnormally raise the ratio when compared to serum protein levels. Secondly, a pleural LDH to serum LDH ratio of greater than 0.6. This is a similar concept to the first condition, except with LDH, which is raised in exudates, as we know, leaking out from cell damage. And then finally, a pleural LDH greater than 2/3 of the normal upper limit for the serum LDH. If none of those criteria are met, then we would consider the effusion to be a transudate. If all of them are met, or even if one of them is met, then we consider it to be an exudate.
Okay, so to summarize, a pleural effusion can be a transudate or an exudate. And we use Light's criteria to differentiate between the two. If either of the pleural to serum protein or LDH ratios are high, or if the pleural LDH level is more than 2/3 of the upper limit of the serum normal range, then an exudate is likely and you consider an alternative diagnosis. If all three conditions are not met, a transudate is likely and then you should stick with your acute heart failure diagnosis. Okay, so we've gone right through from assessment to management, focusing on a few key areas such as x-ray signs and effusions. This seems like a good place to wrap up today, since we have a lot of nice, useful information to digest.
Hi everyone, this is your summary of acute heart failure. So acute heart failure is a clinical syndrome that presents rapidly over hours to days with a similar presentation and etiology as chronic heart failure. Common causes include acute coronary syndrome, acute renal impairment, and acute atrial fibrillation or arrhythmia. Approach any case of acute heart failure with an ADE assessment, Desaturating patients will need oxygen and an ABG. Patients should also have a chest x-ray, which may show the five signs of heart failure, including alveolar shadowing, curly B lines, cardiomegaly, upper lobe diversion, and pleural effusions, which can be remembered by A, B, C, D, E. Echocardiogram is the definitive investigation. The goal of management is offloading any excess fluid, and therefore this requires strict fluid balance monitoring and adjustment. Helpful conservative measures include sitting the patient up and measuring the patient's weight daily. Medically, diuresis in the form of intravenous furosemide is the mainstay of treatment, and once stabilised, they will need long-term medication optimization. Patients with recurrent or refractory pleural effusions may need a chest drain. A chest drain comprises of three bottles that work by draining the pleural contents, bubbling the displaced air through fluid to prevent reaspiration, allowing for the fine tuning of pressure and suction. Chest drains are classically inserted into the safe triangle, which is a region of the chest wall demarcated by the lateral borders of pec major and latissimus dorsi, the fifth intercostal space, and the base of the axilla. Effusions, meanwhile, can be categorised into either transudates or exudates. Transudates are fluids with lower protein and LDH content, typically produced by the heart, liver, and renal failure. Meanwhile, exudates are typically produced by inflammatory processes that result in cell death. Light's criteria is what we can use to differentiate between transudates and exudates. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. Bye.